Hello, everyone. Welcome. I will start by going around and greeting everyone, starting with Joan. And John. Ellen. Yashetsoki. Mark. Jim. Bob K. Andy, Peter, Marv, Shoketsu, Paulette, Karen, Jeannie, Soong, Pat, Vin, Mary, Brian, Paula, Alex, Raven, Randy, Sabrina, and Ruth Ann. All right. The one thing that I can think of to announce is that next Sunday there will be a guest speaker, Reverend Ryushin Creedon, who has spoken at Brightway before. I mean, at, you know, via Zoom. And I'm not sure what his topic is, but stay tuned in the newsletter. Hopefully we'll get a little preview of what he'll be talking about next weekend. Any questions about anything coming up or anything that I should announce that people can think of? Okay. So today I will be talking about what I learned from Kjogan Carlson. So his picture is on the altar behind me. And for those of you who were here earlier, we did our, instead of our usual chanting service, we did our founder's ceremony for Kjogan. And as I explained at the beginning of that, it's traditional in Soto Zen temples to do a founder's ceremony once a year, somewhere around the time of the passing of your temple's founder. And your temple founder is considered to be like essentially the person who literally founded the temple. It's their teacher that they credit. So Kyogen is our honorary founder, as my teacher Gyokuko will be once she passes on. So they are the founders of our temple, even though I'm the founder of our temple. Just like at Dharma Rain, when they do their founder ceremony, it's for their teacher Roshi Kennett. So it's a acknowledgement of for the role that they played in the establishment of your temple, but also, you know, it's something of a memorial as well. And so we do it in September, as close as possible to the date of Kyogen's passing, which was yesterday, September 18th. He died of a sudden heart attack in 2014. And he was definitely one of those people that, I mean, nobody should pass away, but there's some people that you just like, no, he had, you know, 20 plus years left of vital teaching and leadership and who knows what still to come. And so it was a great blow to all of us. And I'm sure at some point during today's talk that I will tear up. So I wanted to start off today by talking just a little bit about lineage in Zen and what it means and why it matters. And then a little bit of an outline of our Dharma, what we call the Dharma cloud lineage. So, you know, what comes through me and is represented by other folks, kind of like So-on's a Dharma sister. We are both like in that same lineage. And so we'll do the outline of that, and then I'll talk about what I learned from Kyogen, and this is like by no means an exhaustive list, and it's kind of a brainstorm, and I'm sure other things will come up. So in terms of lineage, if you are unfamiliar, when we do our regular chanting service on Sundays, we recite a list of names all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha and then his students, and then it goes from teacher to student, teacher to student, teacher to student throughout the last 2,500 plus years. And not all of that list is entirely accurate in the sense that, you know, it looks like maybe a couple of these people didn't actually meet each other, or whatever, but for the most part, it's quite true. And what it reflects is the idea that, you know, you can learn the Dharma from reading or listening. You can meditate. And so there's a lot that you can benefit from in terms of Buddhist and Zen practice just on your own. But we say there's something very essential and important about other people. So this is essentially, this is a manifestation of the treasure of Sangha, the treasure of other people. We are social beings, and there's a way that things don't really come alive, they don't really get tested until we bring them into relationship with other people. And in particular, if we're going to be passing on a tradition, so not something that I just made up, maybe I could make up something really cool and y'all would be attracted to coming and listening to it. But that's the idea, is that, you know, I may have some innovations and some different ways of expressing things, but that I'm not just making something up, that I am helping to carry a tradition. And in order to carry that tradition properly, hopefully, right, we have this tradition of the teacher and student. So the teacher mentors the student until they say, okay, you can carry this Dharma. And I like to think that those of us who have received what we call Dharma transmission, whether that we have in our lineage, both lay and ordained people who have received that kind of transmission, that if you dropped us on a desert island, we could recreate the tradition. Maybe not in its entirety. Maybe we don't know all the sutras by heart or all that, but we have enough of the core elements that we could recreate it for the sake of ourselves and others. So that's part of that value of lineage. And if you are curious about, and it's also, it's a kind of a protection for the tradition and for the people practicing it. Because if you meet somebody in a street corner and they're setting themselves up as a Soto Zen teacher, you can ask them, well, what is your lineage? And if they're like, rah, 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 you know, they don't admit their lineage or whatever, then you go, that's interesting. Like, who's vouching for this person? So if you're able to like trace somebody's lineage, it's a legitimizing effect. So there's a lot to that, but in terms of, you know, what I'm going to talk about today, lineage is like also a kind of a family, like it's a family line or a family tree. So you end up, certain lineages have certain traditions, and they diverge a little bit, right? So you go to different sotas and temples, they're going to feel a little different. And it does depend on this thing of lineage, and it's kind of familial. So you end up with this family flavor, which, you know, changes over time, but has some core things. So much of what I'm going to talk about that I learned from Kyogen in some ways is a little bit inseparable from our lineage flavor. Because for one thing, a student chooses a teacher. So he chose Roshi Kennett, I chose Gyokuko. So in a way, you might choose what you resonate with. So it's difficult to separate what I learned from Kyogen from this just, you know, a familial flavor. And much of it is what I would like to carry on, and hopefully I manifest to some extent. So in terms of our Dharma Cloud lineage history, so we came up with the name Dharma Cloud to identify, so this lineage that comes, as I'll explain, through Shasta Abbey and then through Kyogen and Gyokoko, who are a married couple. So my formal teacher was Gyokoko, but she was married to Kyogen. And if you got one as a teacher, you kind of got both as a teacher, right? And so we call it Dharma Cloud. Anyone who comes as a student through Gyokoko or Kyogen or any of their students are in what we call the Dharma Cloud lineage, because they both had the Dharma name. Roshi Kennet, Kyogen, and Gyokoko all had the Dharma name Ho'u, which means Dharma Cloud. So it all begins, and I am going to share my screen for some photos because it's Zoom, so we might as well. So in the 1960s, an English woman named Peggy Kennett was, like I said earlier, she was a church organist, a musician in the Anglican church, and she ended up meeting Kato Chisan, this Japanese monk. He was traveling around the world trying to spread Soto Zen, and she met him, and they started talking about the possibility of her traveling to Japan to train with him. And eventually this happened. So I'll show you. So this is, on the right is Peggy Kennett, and on the left is Kato Chisan. And it's all a very fascinating story, which is included on the Brightway Zen website. If you go to, I mean, think about us and then lineage and lineage history, this story is told. So she goes to Japan and she ends up practicing at Sojiji Monastery. He was the abbot at Sojiji Monastery, and that's one of the main head temples in Japan. And the irony of this picture is she wasn't, as a woman and a foreigner, she wasn't actually allowed to sleep in the Soto. This is the traditional monastic hall, but here she's sitting. So this is what the meditation hall looks like in a traditional Japanese monastery. So the monks meditate in that little 3x6 mat. They meditate there, they eat there, they sleep there. So, but anyway, she did go through some intense training in Japan. And then what Kato Chisan really wanted her to do was to go establish a monastery in the West. So she ended up establishing Shasta Abbey, which is in Northern California near Mount Shasta, in 1970. And it was quickly populated with a bunch of hippies. But who were not able to bring their hippie ways to the monastery. It was a very, and remains a very strict monastery. And this is a picture. This isn't from Kyogen and Gyokoko's time. This is more recent, but this is the Shasta Abbey ceremony hall. And, you know, you'll see some, it's very different than ours. It's like interesting kluge between really traditional Japanese Soto monasteries, which would have a giant altar you can actually get on and like all this stuff, and like Western kitsch. it's a strange kind of aesthetic, but if you can imagine, this is, you know, Kyogen and Gyokoko helping to build this place back in the 70s. So Kyogen, in 1972, Kyogen arrived, was ordained. I wish I had some pictures of him as a young monk. He spent 10 years there, 9 of them as Roshi Kennett's personal assistant. And Gyokoko arrived in 1975. So Kyogen was transmitted in 74, but he stayed. And then 1982, Kyogen and Gyokoko got married. And they said in one of Kyogen's obituaries, it says it was like several years of chaste courtship. And they got married with Roshi Kennett's blessing. And here's the totally cute picture of them in the 80s when they left the monastery to come up to Portland to help lead the Portland and Eugene priories. So the Shasta Abbey has like, you know, small temples that they established around the country. And then in 86, Kyogen Gyokoku established Dharmarain Zen Center independently of Shasta. And that is a long and involved story, which involves some pain and difficulty. Roshi Kennett changed her requirements and asked them to be celibate and for one of them to come back to the monastery. And there were many other things. And so it was a very painful decision, but they became independent of Shasta. And here's a picture of an early session and they established when the Dharmarain Zen Center, the subtitle of it is a Soto Zen temple for lay practice. So one of the things that Kyogen and Gyokoku really wanted to do was to support lay practice in particular, because at Shasta, the emphasis is really on the monastery, on monastic practice, and that, you know, as a lay person, you can kind of, you know, practice on the sidelines. It may have changed over the years more recently now, but it was definitely a sense that like lay practice was kind of second class practice. So they wanted to really support lay practice. And eventually, after a couple of years, they managed to buy this beautiful house that I spent many years living in southeast Portland. And they established the temple there. There was Zendo in the living room, long blue shag carpet. And then they ended up being able to buy a church building. They were end up able to buy a church building that was right next door. So let me see if I can pull that up. Here we go. So that's the Portland Dharma Center, which the Dharmarain no longer owns, but there is still a Buddhist group that owns that and operates there. And that's what it looks like inside, a very beautiful Zendo. And let's see. So moving on to Kyogen. the Carlsons, stayed true to the Shasta emphasis in terms of teaching and practice, with the addition of the lay practice piece. They emphasize Zazen and precepts and ceremony being ordained into your life, and the what I call the Dharmarain approach. So the reason that they named their temple Dharmarain Zen Center is Dharmarain is a image from the Lotus Sutra, a parable about how the Dharma rains down equally on all beings, all different size plants, and they just take up what they need. So Kyogen and Gyokoku's model was not at all to present like, here is the true way to practice. And, you know, if you don't sign up for the program, you don't cut it. It's like, come and take what you need. Join us for weekday sitting. And that's it. Or come just for Dharma talks, or for all of it, or just come for work practice day, or, you know, whatever you find beneficial, you are welcome to come for. And then I showed up in 1995 and I practiced there. And then I moved into residency in 1999. And in 2001, I was ordained. So what I learned from Kyogen, in a way, I wish I could just keep that picture of him up because it speaks to this, but I mean, I learned so much. I'm not talking here about, you know, how to take the meditation posture and how to do this ceremony and the understanding of this or that teaching. I mean, that goes without saying. He, for many years, and really throughout my whole time there, Kyogen was, I would say, like the primary public voice of the Zen Center. He did most of the talks until many of his students and Gyokoku students got, you know, far enough in their practice that they started giving a lot of the talks as well. But Gyokoku is more of a in action teacher. So her primary teaching was in the kitchen, doing cooking for the community. And, you know, so I joined her in the kitchen and starting the children's program. And so you really just, you wanted to work beside her to pick up her teaching. And she was also great in face-to-face interview. But Kyogen was the primary teacher, if you, in the more traditional sense. So I learned an immense amount from him. And as you, as many of you are probably familiar with, if you have found liberation, healing, relief, strength, if you have found things like that in the Dharma, it brings up a profound gratitude for, you know, the circumstances, the people, the tradition that brought that to you. And I feel like, in a way, like we kind of like a duck imprinting on whatever, you know, bird raises it, we kind of imprint on the people who shared that Dharma with us for the first time, and we're just like, ah. So but specifically, things that I think of when I think of Kyogen, I would say confidence without rigidity. So he manifested this in his teaching and in his manner of speech, but also really in his physical manner. So he was kind of a floppy guy. He was tall and thin, and you know, he'd wear these, you know, Shasta robes, not fancy robes at all. And when he, certainly he sat up straight in Zazen, but, you know, when he walked, he just kind of loped. And if he wasn't sitting in Zazen, he was usually slouching. I remember being in a class that was like different forms of practice or something, but Hogen Baize was sitting on the futon, and then Kyogen was sitting on the futon, and they were leading this class together. And Hogen Baize is the kind, like, I mean, he's going to sit full lotus on that futon while he teaches the class. You know, he's going to be like this. And it's very impressive, right? But Kyogen was just like, I mean, he was just totally leaning back, and his limbs were all over the place. And, you know, he wore these Nike flip-flops, and it was a very, he was very at ease. His manner, his physical manner was at ease. It was always appropriate, not sloppy or careless, but definitely without pretension, definitely without any sense of like, oh, ooh, I'm a Zen priest and I'm walking across the street. What are people going to think about me? You know, he didn't have that at all. But there was something unshakable about him that it's kind of like in my experience of Aikido, where if you tense up against, you know, an opponent or whatever, that you will create tension and conflict. But he just didn't do that. So there was anything that you brought to him, he could meet. And you didn't get a sense that he was being defensive or he was maintaining some kind of position. And yet, you know, he didn't freak out either. He was just, he remained very steady and unshakable. And through all of this, I should say, he had his blind spots and shortcomings. He was fully human. I disagreed with him about tons of things. I'm sure I was a really annoying student. So none of this is idealism. And in a way, that's a core part of his teaching, that he had these aspects that you could aspire to, this confidence and this unshakability and this, you know, compassion and whatever, but it wasn't because somehow he was a superhuman being and, you know, somebody we could never be like. It was an intriguing mix of just normal humanness, very down to earth, and these qualities. Another piece, and some of these are related. I learned that the Dharma is both dependent on form and independent of form. So in Zen, we talk about form is our established ways of doing things in a culture or a tradition. So we have monastic forms, ways that monks are supposed to operate. And when we're in the meditation hall, there are forms. You bow to your seat and you bow away, or you do these different established ways of doing things. You put your shoes straight when you come in the door. You put the shoes together and line them up with other people's shoes. And our sitting also has a form to it, right? We sit up upright and we have this way of doing it. And Kyogen's training, as I discussed, was very strongly monastic. So he spent, you know, 10 years in this intensive monastery. And his early years of teaching, despite the fact that he really wanted to support lay practice, his early years of teaching naturally were full of stories about monastic practice and about the monastery. So, but despite that, he firmly championed what we call the idea of the monk of body and monk of mind. So this goes back further in the tradition than Kyogen, but the idea is that a monk of body is somebody in this monastic form. They, you know, shave their head, they give up everything, they wear robes, they conduct themselves in a certain way, they, you know, live in a community, etc. A monk of mind is someone who, so that monk of body renounces many worldly pleasures and privileges. They don't have their own home, they don't drink alcohol, they don't have, you know, they don't watch TV. This is the strict modern Zen monks, perhaps not, but like certainly this has the roots in the original Buddhism, where monks have like 250 rules. So the monk of body renounces worldly attachments in a literal physical way, but a monk of mind renounces worldly attachments, you know, in spirit, if you will. So this is the classic Vimalakirti Sutra tells about this, you know, lay practitioner who all of the Buddha's other students were scared to go debate because he was so realized. But he engaged in the world. He was a householder. He had businesses. He had wife and children and all of this. But his point was that he could do all of this without being attached to it all. And that's what really mattered. So the idea is that if you are a monk of body and you have literally given things up, but you're not a monk of mind, if you still have attachments, which is very easy to do, you just physically give up this stuff, but then you're attached to whatever spiritual, you know, status, how cool you look in your robes, who, whatever, you can find attachments. So if you're still attached, if you're not a monk of mind, you're pretty worthless, but you can be a monk of mind without being a monk of body. So that I feel like Kyogen really, you know, established his teaching, he and Gyokugo, to make that a reality. So he was a fierce champion of full-fledged lay practice, He's one of the, he and Gyokuko are one of the first and few Soto Zen priests in the West to fully empower lay teachers. So there's other lineages which might give some, first of all, they might just ordain somebody who's more or less a lay person, but they ordain them. Or they give them some kind of acknowledgement, but not like our lay teachers are empowered to give the precepts, and they're also empowered to transmit what they have. So they might have a student someday that they then transmit as a lay teacher. So therefore, a lineage can continue through them. So that power of transmission is the critical piece. So Kyogen and Gyokuko really meant it. But, you know, at a deeper level, this kind of form or not form, form was very important. And yet, you know, in some senses is not. So what is it we are really looking for if it's not dependent on the form? What is that? So another category of teaching, I guess, would be conviction without dogmatism. So I feel like Kyogen had, and I hope many of us have, deep faith in the Dharma as a path of awakening, but also fully ready to question anything. I don't know that I would have been able to practice at Dharma Rain or practice as deeply as I did if I had thought there was something that I couldn't ask or question. If there was something that was just like, ooh, you know, reverence for Kanzeon. Ooh, you know, like you better not ask about that. That's some, anything was open for question. And that was, for me, very essential. And at the same time, Kyogen and Gyokuko were not overly eager to innovate or change the forms or the tradition just for the sake of it. Like, let's just innovate and improve. And they had deep respect for the forms as they had been received. And as, you know, they were further back even than Roshi Kennet. But they were ready to adapt after careful consideration, and they added things and adapted things. But that conviction without dogmatism, I feel, was exemplified by something Kyogen said about, he was often involved in interfaith dialogue groups. And he said, you know, that is fine, you know, having these dialogues, finding common ground, etc. But he says, it's a little sad if you don't think your way is the best. And I love that kind of suggesting that we hold that, you know, ambiguity, that we could have a dialogue with somebody and know, okay, from your point of view, from your experience, this other thing is legitimate. Huh, that is very interesting. And to respect that, at the same time, if you don't think your way is best, then you should go look for a different way, right? So hopefully you have a conviction about your own way that, like, man, this is the most profound path on earth. So I thought that was a sweet reflection of that. And the Dharma is, it's always just this strong sense that the Dharma is a path or a method. Its teachings and practices are tools, and their legitimacy comes from whether we find them useful in our own direct experience, not from belief. So, you know, here's an example, what a story Kyogen told about during his time at Shasta. He was riding a Greyhound bus, and he had his priest robes on, and some evangelical Christian sat down next to him and was chatting him up about Christ during the ride. And the guy said, you know, if I could take you back in time and I could show you that Christ died and rose from the dead, would it change your mind? And Kyogen thought for a moment, he said, no. he didn't say it at the time, but later on he thought, now what if he had asked that guy, if I could take you back in time and show you that Christ did not die and rise from the dead, would that change your faith? So it's a, you know, Buddhism, a different kind of faith. Also, let's see. Be yourself enthusiastically without being attached to being yourself. I guess another way to put this is authenticity without narrative. And it's something that we just have to keep practicing to achieve. How do we respond mindfully but spontaneously? Each of us has our own perspectives, our own strengths and weaknesses, our own karma, and our own, you know, every one of us has our own responses and things to contribute. And can we do that, you know, without inhibition or shame, but also without the extra, like, oh, I need to express myself, you know, no added narrative. And I feel like Kyogen just really manifested that kind of natural authenticity. Another aspect that I would like to model myself after him is deep respect for all people, even those who are difficult or annoying. So one of the things that I remember fondly is, in many, many times, you know, we're in the meditation hall, Kyogen gives a talk, then there's the Q&A session, right? And sometimes people would, you know, they say something and they, especially the longer a sangha lasts, more over time, like sometimes people would just clearly they want to get up on a soapbox and use the question to, you know, make a point or, you know, call attention to themselves or something. It's just kind of, it's not really an appropriate question. It's kind of an obnoxious question. It kind of diverges from the topic. It's not interesting to people, whatever. And I would always, you know, my first reaction was always a little annoyance, and I just watched time after time after time when Kyogen would listen respectfully. And I'd be thinking, like, you know, okay, so what, you know, kind of blow off answer is he going to, you know, give this person? But he always really, he listened and he found something. He found something of value to respond to, no matter what the person brought. And I always just thought that was so, so amazing. I mean, so like him getting out of the way, right? It wasn't about him and his convenience or what he wanted to convey, just a real meeting of people. And I'm sure others who knew him would be able to back me up on that. And I think an example of this, a manifestation of it, is the ongoing dialogue he had with evangelical Christians, socially conservative evangelical Christians. So he ended up with this friendship with this professor at, I think it called something different now, but it was the Multnomah Bible College, you know, conservative Bible college. You know, the folks who go here think that if you're gay, you're going to hell. I mean, this is serious stuff here. But he ended up having this dialogue with this professor. They met at some interfaith thing. And there was this mutual respect and being able to, like, you know, at some level, Kyogen thinks Paul Metzger is utterly deluded and Paul thinks Kyogen's going to hell. But they could sit and have a beer and have a sincere, respectful conversation, and they brought that further to their communities. So I think it might still actually be happening. They would have, you know, for maybe 6 months at a time, a group of Zen Center people who would volunteer and a group of the Bible College people, and they would meet and have dialogues about different topics, some of them quite difficult. But I think it was very healing and eye-opening for many people. And then, very important aspect of what I learned from Kyogen is And there's different ways I could phrase this, but I would say acceptance of the mystical without obsession with the mystical. So this is exemplified by, so Roshi Kennett, their teacher, Kyogen Gyoko's teacher, you can go out there and find some of her books. She wrote about her enlightenment experiences, and some of them were pretty far out, and she had visions. And then later on, she did energy work as well. And it's much of it is what I would call, from my personal point of view and preference, like pretty woo-woo stuff. Not at all the Zen that I looked to get into. So I was reading some of these, you know, Roshi Kennett's books in the Zen Center library. And then this is many, many years ago, where I had lunch, and there's, you know, Kyogen at one end of the table and Gyokuko at the other. It's just the three of us for lunch. So I bring this up, and I want them to confirm that, like, yeah, that's a bunch of bullshit. Woo, boy. But they didn't. They just said, yeah, well. And I found that very disconcerting, but it was part of a larger message. It wasn't so much an endorsement of that stuff. They didn't talk about that themselves, but I think what it was a message that beware of teachings that you just want to dispense with, that they make you uncomfortable, and you just don't want to deal with them. Like, what is that about? So they would always encourage you to not just throw away or blow off teachings that you might find a little aversive at first, but to explore them and learn from them. And that, not that they would, those aren't really official teachings, those Roshi Kennett vision books, but other things within the more traditional Soto Zen canon, you know, they would not let you off the hook easily by just saying, oh yeah, that's dumb. So in addition, our lineage gently and subtly holds the possibility of Kensho within the tradition. So Kensho is a dramatic awakening experience, is one way to put it. It literally means seeing the true nature of the self. So it's experience of, you know, what we're always talking about, the self is empty. You know, we're empty of inherent enduring self nature. And this is a very experiential, you know, shift. Like, oh my God, it's true. It's and this can happen according to Kyogen and according to my observations as well. I mean, for a small number of people, this can happen in a fairly dramatic way. Like on October 18th, this thing happened, right? For others, Kyogen said, it's a little more like, you know, the lotus either blossoms like this, or it, you know, kind of slowly opens. So in the end, the experience is not exactly the same, right? I can't say that I have had a Kensho, but as far as I can tell, I have awakened slowly but surely to the same reality. But when that kind of experience happens, it's very important for it to be properly held and acknowledged, because otherwise it can be quite traumatic and people don't know how to incorporate that into their lives. So within our tradition, another thing that's kind of like, it's acceptance of the mystical. By the mystical, I just mean beyond our kind of everyday dependent dimension experience. Something that it's not supernatural, nothing in Zen is supernatural, but just it's beyond our usual experience. So in our lineage, we agree with what Suzuki Roshi said He's quoted at the beginning of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. They call it Satori. And they asked him why he didn't talk about it more. Like, why is it not in that book? And he said, it's not that Satori is unimportant, but it's not the part of Zen that needs to be stressed. So when you start talking about awakening experiences, people start to try to have them. And that's just kind of not the way that it works. Sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. And it doesn't really seem to have a whole lot to do with, it doesn't seem to have anything to do, frankly, with what you would like to have happen. And then let's see. I wanted to leave some time for any additional stories or questions, but very importantly, one of, I think, Kyogen's main teachings is on radical non-duality. So he's absolutely insistent, as have many Zen teachers over time, absolutely insistent on giving up dualistic ideas. And not because that's holy or superior, but just because that is the way of liberation. So as Dogen says in Fukan Zazengi, the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? The true vehicle is self-sufficient. What need is there for special effort? Indeed, the whole body is free from dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from this very place. What is the use of traveling around to find it? And yet, if there's a hair's breadth deviation, it is like the gap between heaven and earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. So we already have it, but it's a matter of letting go of our preferences. But when we try to let go of our preferences, and that's a challenge, then we say, well, there must be something more than my preferences going on here, right? So you come and you say to the teacher, well, you know, I can't do this because, you know, my Zazen isn't focused. I can't do this because I'm just kind of a weak person. I can't do this because I can't concentrate. I can't do this because I'm old, or I can't do this because whatever. And it's like, no. Like, none of that is an excuse. That's not the nature of what we're looking for. So Kyogen was always that, as Gyokoko was, as any good teacher is, I think. But I remember going to Kyogen and just, I would fall asleep in Zazen so predictably and so pervasively that I would go away to meditation retreat. So yeah, I was really hoping to like get deep in meditation and, you know, have some insights and whatever. And I would sleep usually maybe around day four, I might wake up a little, but that's a long time. That's like 8 hours of meditation for for 3 or 4 days that I slept through like this. And I was so frustrated. And so I'm like, why can I not make this happen? And there's some deficiency in me. I must not really want this, but I don't know. And I would just, you know, it's like, now I can convince Kyogen there's something wrong with me. Now I can go in there and say, you know, confess this terrible flaw and be like, see, and he'd just be like, yeah. It's just like, it's not a big deal. And to have that constantly reflected back at you that, no, that's not an obstacle. That's fine. No biggie. It is a challenge, but it's also encouraging. As soon as we create some kind of idea about how it should be, we're creating our own problem. And then just a couple more things. I think one of the great values that I got from Kyogen was the value of just keep showing up. that this isn't about a practice that you do in order to get somewhere or achieve something. This is just settling in and doing the same thing over and over and over indefinitely. It is a practice that we just make into part of our lives. And then finally, I guess one lesson that I can think of that Kyogen and the loss of Kyogen taught me is the immeasurable, but often kind of subtle and elusive value of Sangha. So, my experience, so when Kyogen died, I had not been involved with, I've been practicing at Dharma Rain for a good 4 or 5 years already. You know, I came and established Bright Ways Zen, and that was, you know, mostly what I did. And so I didn't see him very often. You know, he's not my primary teacher. I didn't go, you know, meet with him. I think many people were deeply impacted by his loss, and he has many formal students. And so they actually lost their primary teacher. But for me, it probably felt more like, and some of you will have had this experience, but it's like losing a parent, a parent who was a good parent, which it's something that you relied on. Like, you know, he helped me build my faith in the Dharma, and for that to be shifted and changed was like, I don't know. So it's very poignant, you know. It's almost like an intense gratitude mixed with loss and just like, oh my God, I can't believe that's gone. That's like the moon, you know, disappearing from the sky. It's just that part of your universe is no longer there. And so that then suggest to me, you know, like we don't even recognize, I think, sometimes to what extent we support one another just in our presence, you know, even though there might not be explicit interactions and, you know, explicitly rewarding things going on, we are holding each other up. So with that, I will, let's see, I think, Soon, would you like to say anything? As one of Kyogen's formal
students. Definitely. I would. Thank you so much for this ceremony. He was just a one of a kind and quirky and funny. And sometimes he'd get mad, you know, but he's just, I don't know. You know, what I really appreciated about him is the, like you said, the flavor of Dharma Rain, and that you're continuing this is, and I remember him saying in a Dharma talk, it's kind of like a Protestant church flavor, where it's the community church and people even, you know, there are funeral rites and marriage ceremonies. And people bring their families, and they would have, you know, the Dharma school would come in. And I didn't see the Dharma school too much, but they would come in for these big, you know, like Sagaki and things like that. And it was just like this big family thing that was kind of on the outside. But then on the inside, you could go to Sanzen with both of these teachers and talk about some really deep stuff, really intense spiritual stuff and just daily life and experience, you know? And there's like no secret knowledge there at Dharma Rain. And I'm just very blessed to just kind of, I actually kind of Googled Dharma Rain. I had some kind of awakening experience on my back porch. And I had a friend who sort of was Zen adjacent. He studied it in a martial arts setting. And he was like, you need to talk to a teacher about that. I was like, yeah. And so I just kind of, Googled Kyogen, really. And I went to I started going there and I went to Sanzen. And like, it was really scary to me, but I remember he said, I can't even remember the question, but he said, you know, that Star Trek episode where the people are like black on one side of their face and white on the other side of their face. I was like, this is the guy. That's my teacher. And I asked him to be my teacher like within like 3 months of showing up, which is kind of, I guess that's unusual. I don't know.
I don't know. I asked Gyokuko within a few months of showing up too. But some people take years and years and years.
I guess you just knew, you know. So I could go on for days. I loved him. Got to go to China with him, you know, got to play music with him. You know, I got to disagree with him. And yeah, he's sorely, sorely missed. It feels like there's things that are unresolved. It's like, no, you're supposed to be here to talk about this thing that we were talking about before you died. We're supposed to resolve that, right? But, you know, still grateful. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And grateful to you for this today and for everything you do.
Domio, I think Kyogen would have been so proud of you.
Because
everything you loved and admired about him, you've shown that to us.
Thank you. I hope so.
You modeled yourself beautifully after him.
So. Or like I said, maybe I was already like this and I just chose people who were like me, you know. I don't know.
Oh, don't be so modest. Incidentally, I always wanted to know, the title Bright Way Zen is such an unusual name for a Zen center. Did the Bright Way thing have anything to do with Kyogen being so upbeat? And
I don't know. I guess I kind of liked the fact that, you know, Dharmarain Zen Center, you'd often just refer to it as Dharmarain. So we have a name that's like, you say Bright Way, you can refer to the Zen Center as Bright Way, as opposed to like, you know, the Zen Center of Beaverton or something, you know, it has a name. But no, actually Bright Way is modeled after my Dharma name, which is Domyo, which means Bright Way. But I didn't want to, the Zen Center has different characters because I didn't want to name the Zen Center after me. But I thought it was a great name for a Zen Center. So it's different characters. But some people are like, what is it? What did you say? Right Way Zen? I'm like, no. Not that. We have a minute. Any last comments or questions? Yeshe.
I have a clarifying question, and it's a very simple one. Perhaps I misunderstood you. Did you say that Kyogen and Gyokuko founded Mount Shasta, or was Mount Shasta already there? Because it's so strikingly different.
Oh yeah,
Dharmarain. That it's hard for me to understand that they found both.
No. Roshi Kennett, their teacher, founded Shasta Abbey. So that large lady that I showed in the pictures, she founded Shasta. And they were monks there, so they helped build it, you know, over the years. But then they went and, you know, started the place in Portland. They started Dharmarain. So the ironic thing is that Roshi Kennett had some pretty negative experiences in Japan. I mean, traditional hardcore monastic training is really brutal anyway. And when you are a foreigner and you are a woman, like it was really, really tough. So especially after she got empowered by her teacher, and it turned out if anybody wants to log off because it's going a little long, feel free. But it turns out that her teacher, Kato Chisan, kind of planned this because he wanted to empower women. And there were many ceremonies that Roshi Kennett became empowered to do because she received full transmission that other women in Japan were not, were only allowed to do in secret or weren't allowed to do officially. So he kind of like used her as kind of a battering ram. I mean, I'm sure it was sincere as well. And he wanted her to go to the West and establish a monastery. But she had these negative experiences, particularly toward her end of the end of her training. After she was transmitted, he died. So her protector was gone. And so when she got to the West, she kind of wanted to remove everything Japanese from Zen. So she didn't call it Zazen. She called it Serene Reflection Meditation. They started singing the chants instead of chanting Japanese style. So they changed everything, but except the core Dharma, right? But then when Kyogen and Gyokoku started their own place, obviously it started with that flavor, but over time, Kyogen's and Gyokoku's primary relationships were with other Soto Zen priests because Shasta Abbey excommunicated them. So they became more like more traditional Soto Zen in terms of form and appearance. They departed from Shasta, which I'm kind of glad of myself. When they tell some of the stories about what they did at the monastery, I'm like, I would not have survived there. That was sounds like a wacky place. I'm not saying that today Shasta is a wacky place, but it still looks like that. It still looks a little interesting. So, all right. Well, thank you all for being here. I'll say our closing verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.